Things that's so interesting about the book of Acts is to see how the gospel is presented and how it fares in these different places, different audiences, different cultures, different backgrounds, different problems that various people have. And what you see is Paul giving the same gospel message, but how he presents it will very much depend upon who his audience is. And then the reception of that gospel is very interesting as you look at the various sermons that Acts records. So we're here looking at Paul preaching in Macedonia. Paul and Silas and Timothy and of course Luke, as we've seen, is with them also. And so these major cities of Macedonia, Philippi, we talked about Paul preaching the gospel there last time. And then what we see is that he comes to Thessalonica and Berea. And so we want to go ahead and look at the material here in Acts chapter 17 regarding Paul's preaching at Thessalonica. And let me just give you a little bit of background on Thessalonica. It's the actual capital city of Macedonia. Philippi is the largest and most prominent city, but the seat of government was actually in Thessalonica. And it is a city with a sizable Jewish community, and so we want to look here at what happens when Paul preaches in the Jewish synagogue. Let's go ahead and read these opening verses. Now, while they had traveled through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And according to Paul's custom, he went to them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, and saying, "This Jesus, whom I am proclaiming to you, is the Christ." And some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, along with a large number of the God-fearing Greeks and a number of believing women. But the Jews, becoming jealous and taking along some wicked men from the marketplace, formed a mob and set the city in an uproar. And attacking the house of Jason, they were seeking to bring them out to the people. And when they did not find them, they began dragging Jason and some brethren before the city authorities, shouting, "These men who have upset the world have come here also. And Jason has welcomed them, and they all act contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, Jesus." So I want us to look at the makeup of the city and the response that we see the gospel having here. It says that Paul reasoned in the synagogue for three Sabbath days. And what was the response from the Jews in the synagogue? Overall, how does Luke assess the overall Jewish response? Nick's shaking his head. What does Luke say about the overall response of the Jews? What, Nick? All right, comparatively minor. And I think that's important, and I want you to keep that in mind. He does say some Jews did believe, but only some. And it's very obvious that the major opposition that this gospel message is going to have is from the large proportion of the Jewish population who are not going to accept this gospel message about this crucified criminal is our Jewish Messiah. That was something they were not going to accept. But some of the Jews did believe. But what's interesting about this is the greatest success Paul had was with what group? I said that many of the Gentiles did believe. In fact, specifically, when you look at this, it says in verse 4 that a large number of the God-fearing Greeks and a number of the leading women believed. So what you have here are God-fearing Greeks. And of course, we've talked about that terminology. What does Luke mean in Acts when he talks about God-fearers? Who's that referring to? Gentiles who do believe that this Jewish God, Yahweh, is the true God. And so I want us to really appreciate this. I think sometimes people just assume that the Gentiles who respond to the gospel, they must all have come from some pagan background. Well, the Gentiles do come from a pagan background, but a lot of these Gentiles, by the time they hear the gospel of Jesus, have already been taught about Yahweh by the Jewish population that live in their city. And so some of these Jews had already become God-fearers, believers in Yahweh. And so it is with that group especially that the gospel of Jesus Christ has success at Thessalonica. And also along with some of the very prominent leading women in society, or maybe even government, that may be the point of that expression. But we need to appreciate that there is tremendous opposition from the majority of Jews at Thessalonica who rejected this gospel message. And we're going to see as we go on here just how extensive their opposition became. It says that they stirred up the magistrates, and what was the charge that these unbelieving Jews were labeling against Paul and Silas? That they're preaching a message of disloyalty to our Roman emperor. That they're saying this King Jesus is in opposition to the emperor and is a threat to this whole concept of being a loyal citizen of the Roman Empire. And so that's going to be the charge. In fact, what we're going to see throughout the rest of Acts, as the gospel is presented more and more to the Gentile world, over and over again, that's going to be the issue. And even when Paul ultimately goes to Rome on trial, that's going to be this charge that he's up against. And so this is what the unbelieving Jews, of all things, are labeling against Paul and the gospel.
What's ironic about that?
Mickey? I mean, this was always the issue, as Jews were under the thumb of the Roman Empire. Rome was always having to quell Jewish uprisings of one kind or another. And so the fact that you've got Jews who were saying that these men are teaching a message of disloyalty to the Roman emperor, there's just something, very shameless about that, and certainly ironic. And yet, isn't that what we've seen before? Not just in Acts, but even earlier in the Gospel of Luke? Isn't that exactly what the Jews there in Palestine were saying in order to get Jesus crucified? I mean, they passed all this off as, well, we want to be loyal to Rome, so to be loyal to Rome, crucify Jesus. This is really going to be something that the Apostle Paul is going to make mention of in the first letter that he will write to the Thessalonians. A few months after what we're reading here in Acts, Paul will write them a letter, and he'll talk about the persecution that the Thessalonian brethren are receiving from unbelieving Jews, and it's the same kind of persecution that their Jewish countrymen in Palestine had to receive from the unbelieving Jews there. I think all that's important. Now, it says that when they couldn't get a hold of Paul, that they dragged this disciple Jason out. We don't really know, nothing much is said about him. But Jesus thought he was a Jewish disciple who was housing Paul and Silas. And so the authorities dragged Jason, or the unbelieving Jews dragged Jason out, and ultimately he's brought before the magistrates. And it says ultimately that they secured a pledge from Jason.
Probably how
your version is rendered that. Does anybody have a version that says differently? Most versions say a pledge from Jason. What that apparently is talking about, it may involve money, but also at least what that's talking about, that's really kind of a legal term that Luke is using. And what Jason was having to do was to guarantee to the city magistrates that these men, or at least especially Paul, was not going to come back to the city and causing a furor and all of that. You know exactly how the edict is worded. You know where Luke doesn't tell us that, but ultimately this is obviously all cast in the context of, okay, you have harbored this man who's been upsetting our society and potentially leading an insurrection against the Roman Emperor, and so Jason, you are now responsible for, and you're guaranteeing that he's not going to be back here and cause this problem and all of that. Do you remember anything that Paul said in his letter to the Thessalonians a few months later when he's explained to them about how much he had longed to come back to Thessalonica? Remember the statement that Paul makes as to why he was unable to come back to the city, why he personally was not able to? Anyone recall that? In chapter 2, he says, "But Satan thwarted us." He says, "I more than once wanted to come back to you, but Satan thwarted us." I can't help but think this isn't at least part of what he's talking about here. All of the attention is so focused here upon Paul as the main speaker that even his presence and his teaching there in the city again, that's just going to be viewed by the city authorities as Paul trying to lead some kind of insurrection, which would just make the persecution even hotter upon the Jewish Christian or upon the Christians there. So all of this is what prompts Paul and Silas to go ahead and leave Thessalonica after a fairly brief stay there. And what you see is that they then go to Berea, which is about 50 miles west of the city. All this is connected by a major roadway. And what you see is that Timothy, and I would think also Luke, they're able to have more contact without bringing all this attention upon them. And so even what Paul writes about in the Thessalonian letter is how he, after he had left Macedonia, had sent Timothy back to Thessalonica to see how they were faring. But I want you just to appreciate the fact that Thessalonica, and specifically the Jews of Thessalonica, they are the source of tremendous opposition to the gospel throughout Macedonia. In fact, we'll even see that they bring their opposition all the way to Berea. And that's important because that's what Paul's talking about when he writes the Thessalonians his letter. The unbelieving Jews, they're the main ones causing the problem here. Our comments or questions about that or anything that happens at Thessalonica? All right, look at then what happens at Berea. Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, and apparently those will be referring to women of either noble class or even perhaps governmental positions. So that's significant. Luke always seems to make a point whenever there's an individual or a group of people from the upper crust of society, especially governmental society, that they are converted to the gospel. Luke always wants to mention that. And I think probably the reason why is because throughout the Gentile world, the charge against the gospel is always that they're disloyal to Rome. And, of course, that's what Luke's, I think, in part trying to show, that Christianity was in no way disloyal to Rome. And so you have some conversions like this. All right, look at Berea. Luke's very specific when he talks about the reception that the gospel has in these cities. At Berea, he says, many Jews believe. In fact, what is he say about the Jews of Berea in contrast to those of Thessalonica? All right, they were more fair-minded, more noble-minded than the Jews of Thessalonica. Why? They were willing to search the Scriptures daily to see if the things that Paul was saying really were so. They were open-minded. They were willing to consider that something they had, that was different from what they had been taught all their lives,
might be true, might really be what the Scriptures taught.
So they were not just a group of people that were assuming that their interpretation must always be the right interpretation. They were willing to at least consider the possibility that the Scriptures did talk about a Messiah who would suffer and die and be resurrected, and that was something that would comport with Old Testament prophecy. They never had thought about that before, but they were willing to consider that. And I think it's important to note that the contrast he's making is between the Jews of Berea and the Jews of Thessalonica. It's not a contrast, as I've heard some people make, between the Christian Jews of Berea and the Christian Jews of Thessalonica. That's not the point. Those Jews that were converted at Thessalonica, they were obviously noble-minded too. But the point Luke is making is that when you look at the Jewish populations of both cities, there was a noticeable difference. The Jews of Berea were open-minded, were willing to consider the gospel, and as a result, many of them believed. But it's the Thessalonian Jews who, by and large, rejected the gospel with a fervor, with a real persecution kind of fervor. And so that's the point that we need to note here. And also Luke mentions that also many prominent Gentiles of Berea also did accept the gospel. But then look at what happens. Thessalonian Jews from 50 miles away make their way to Berea and they try to stir up the Berean city authorities against the gospel just like they had done in their own city. Why is it that these unbelieving Jews are so passionately opposed to this gospel message? What's the problem here as far as they see it? Mickey?
They had the same problem that Saul had in the beginning. I mean, they were just adamant about the Jesus being the law. They just went to the ends to punish those that were doing it.
Alright, so they see the gospel of Jesus Christ, Jesus as our Messiah. They see that message as being somehow anti-Mosaic law, as undermining the Mosaic law. Why especially were they thinking that? And what practically was causing them to think along those lines? I'm sorry? Well, yeah, but I mean, there's something else here that we just need to really appreciate that is just generating all this passionate opposition on the part of these Jews. Okay, look at who Paul is preaching this message to. Yeah, he starts in the Jewish synagogues, but he is preaching to the Gentile God-fearers, first of all, and saying, now, by believing in Jesus as the Messiah and serving Him, you as a Gentile can be saved and be part of this Jewish kingdom on par with any other Jew, and you don't have to be circumcised and keep the law of Moses. In other words, you don't have to become a Jew. And then beyond that, he's even going to Gentiles who are not even God-fearers, who have a pagan background. A lot of them are prominent citizens. They're in the government of the city. What did governing officials do as a matter of course as they were beginning their day? They pay homage to the gods. These cities were connected
with pagan worship.
So here Paul is preaching this message of the Jewish kingdom and the promise to Abraham. He's preaching it to Gentiles and saying, you Gentiles can have all these promises that God gave to Abraham on par with Jews.
No distinction.
God shows no partiality. That's what just incites the Jews. You know, Paul would later write to the Corinthians that the cross of Christ
is to the Jews
what?
A stumbling block.
But there's more to that statement than just the fact
that our Messiah is a crucified Messiah, and that was a problem.
The fact that the cross of Christ
was preaching or was saying that even non-Jews can be
saved by the blood of that crucified Messiah. I mean, that was just like pouring gasoline on the fire. And so this is what's going on here. It isn't just that Paul preaches to the synagogues and they don't receive it and then he leaves. No, he preaches to the synagogues and then he goes to the Gentiles in that city and preaches the same message to them. And these Jews just cannot accept that. That's our Jewish kingdom. That's our Jewish promises. Yahweh is
our
God. The Gentiles be judged by God. They can't have what we have. And so this is what's fueling all of this. So these Thessalonian Jews travel 50 miles to try to stamp out the gospel in Berea, just like they tried to do in Thessalonica. It gets so bad that what does Paul have to do? He has to leave the entire province. He leaves Macedonia, totally. And ultimately will come down to Achaia and the city of Athens. Okay. Now, he's not leaving these brethren high and dry.
They're Paul's helpers.
He's sending back to these cities to further teach them, to further exhort them. But what we're seeing is that Paul is just sort of the... lightning rod for all of
this opposition. And as a result of that, he has to actually leave the entire province. So again, it just
kind of helps you appreciate what Paul would later write to the Thessalonians. I wanted to come back to you at Thessalonica many times, but Satan thwarted us. And okay, Bill? I don't think it says that, does it? What's it say? I don't know that that'd be the same Jason, Bill. Jason was a common name in Greek. I wouldn't think that, because there he's talking about from Corinth. So I wouldn't think that would be the same Jason.
You might ask this, but the God-fearing Gentiles, would they be practicing Jewish traditions at that point? Would they strictly have their one God, have their own God?
The God-fearing Gentiles would be living in the Greco-Roman culture, living as a Greco-Roman, not as a Jew, but they wouldn't be praying and doing homage to their various deities. They instead would be praying to the Jewish God Yahweh, whom they believed was the true God.
Would they participate in the synagogue?
Well, they couldn't enter the synagogues as an uncircumcised Gentile.
But
that, that really kind of leads me to say something I had meant to say earlier.
Probably another
reason why these unbelieving Jews are so incensed, even about the God-fearing Gentiles who are converted to Paul's teaching. Who do you think made those Gentiles God-fearers to begin with? It was the Jews in their community. That's where those Gentiles
who became God-fearers,
that's where they learned about Yahweh.
So,
I'm sure there's that kind of an issue here. We've taught many of these Gentiles about our Jewish
God Yahweh,
and they've ceased their paganism and begun to pay homage to our Jewish God. But now, Paul, you're stealing them away from us and then teaching them this message that they can be citizens of our Jewish kingdom just like us. So all these dynamics are going on here, okay? All right. Other comments, questions?
Yeah.
in Acts chapter 9, there was a prophecy to Ananias that Paul was going to suffer these things. And that's the same type of havoc that he was causing on the church to begin with. Now he's receiving that particular message. Now
good point from both sides.
Yeah.
All right. So, as a result of all of this, Paul, as we said, has to leave Berea, and not just that city, but the entire province. And he comes down to this province in the southern portion of Greece, that's called Achaia. And the first city that he preaches in at Achaia is Athens. And Paul is there alone. And I want us to go ahead and look at some things here. First of all, just about Athens, I might just show you this. In typical Greek fashion, the city of Athens had two levels. You had the base level city where most people lived, and then you had the Acropolis, the upper city where so many of the governmental facilities were and so many of the long-standing pagan monuments were. And what was the most significant of all of those pagan monuments at Athens? The Parthenon, which of course still stands today. You see the ruins of the Parthenon, but it would have been there in all of its glory in the first century when Paul was there. Just show you this, an artist's rendering of what it would have looked like initially. You see all those friezes along the frontal facade there? Those are all displays of pagan gods and pagan mythology. And everywhere you went in Athens, you just have all of these signs of homage to the deities. What does Luke say was Paul's emotional reaction as he's walking through the streets of Athens? Let's go ahead and read it. Verse 16, now while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was being provoked within him as he was observing the city full of idols. Let me just keep reading. So he was reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be present. And also some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers were conversing with him, saying, what would this idle babbler wish to say? Others were saying he seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. So I want you just to appreciate one of the things that Athens was certainly known for, and that was its paganism and all these monuments. And Paul's spirit is just provoked. I mean, look at how far the world has drifted away from the one true God. I mean, everywhere you look in this city, not only are gods worshipped, but monuments like this are dedicated to gods and goddesses like Athena. The Parthenon was dedicated to Athena, but yet, of course, it had representations of all the major Greco-Roman deities. And it was a tremendous structure, and all these other temples and altars throughout the city. This is what the text is talking about. Paul is just provoked at all of this. When you think about what Athens was noted for, it was certainly noted for pagan worship. And there's something else that Athens was noted for. And this will come into play as Paul preaches here in Athens. What else was Athens especially noted for? Jeremy? All right, their philosophical school. And this is something that I want to talk a little bit about. First of all, it says, starting in verse 22, that Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and began to preach his message. First of all, this reference to the Areopagus, that term was used to refer to Mars Hill. Some of your older versions may say Mars Hill there. Literally, that's what Areopagus means. Ares is the Greek name of Mars, the god of war. And then that Pagus ending, that refers to a hill. So the hill of Mars or the hill of Ares. But the council, the governing council of Athens, they generally would assemble atop the Areopagus, atop Mars Hill, to convene their council. So just the way Luke words this, when he says that Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus, he's talking there about this group of people. This council, known as the Mars Hill Council, or the Areopagus Council, and this is where he's preaching this message. And to me, this is one of the most interesting examples
of Paul's sermons,
where Paul recognizes who his audience is. Let me just tell everybody here, whether you want to be a preacher or whether you're wanting to convert your next door neighbor, you have to think about where that person's coming from. And it's not that you change the gospel message. You present that pure gospel message, but you do present it in a way that they can relate to based upon where they are coming from or where they are coming from. That's exactly what Paul does here. So Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I observe that you are a very religious people in all respects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you." Without getting too far afield in all this, do you notice that Paul doesn't start with "Men of Athens, you are all going to burn in hell because of your idolatry"? That's not how he says this. That's not how he starts this.
We just
read that Luke says Paul was provoked in his spirit because of all this idolatry. He didn't let that sense of emotional provocation, he didn't let that govern what he said. But he starts out and he says, "I observe that you are a religious people." You know, you can find something complimentary about usually even the worst person, even though they are as misguided as they can be. There's something that is commendable. And Paul says, you are a religious people. And he also says, "As I was walking through your city, I found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.'" There's a lot of literary evidence in the Greco-Roman world of this very thing that Paul's talking about. A lot of
ancient writers talk
about altars and monuments to unknown gods. And it apparently is the idea that there was such a concern that there might be some deity that was not honored. And of course, if a deity was not honored, you then run the risk of what happening? Making him mad at you. And so you don't want that. And so they would erect altars to unknown deities.
Or here's a site where you don't know what
particular god might oversee this particular grove or this hill, or, you know, because gods tend to be territorial in their concept. And so they would erect altars to unknown deities. Well, Paul plays off of that. And he says, "I see that you're concerned about not dishonoring some god whose name you don't know, some god whom you're not aware of." And what he's saying is, you really have unwittingly overlooked the most important, in fact, the only true God that there is. But this is how he starts into all of this. Mickey?
It shows you that political correctness started a long time ago.
Well, no, political correctness in our day would say you never talk about any of this stuff at all. Paul's talking about it, but he is saying it in a palatable way. Well, you're right. He's well. I mean, I think the best way to say it is Paul is trying to present the gospel in all of its truth, yet in the most palatable way possible. Now, are most people still not going to like how it tastes? Yeah. But he's trying to present it in as palatable a way way as he possibly can. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the reaction that Paul gets here. Because it's very clear that the philosophical schools, especially the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers, they're the ones who really interact with Paul most and publicly do so. And so let's talk about this. In fact, go back to verse 18. And also some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers were conversing with him. Some were saying, "What would this idle babbler wish to say?" It's an interesting term in the Greek. Spermologos is the Greek term. And literally what it means is seed picker. It's talking about certain birds just kind of fly around, and they pick up a seed there, and then they go over here and pick up a seed there, Well, people were like that. A lot of these uneducated people, they might, because they're living in Athens, they might pick up a little seed of Stoic philosophy here, and they might pick up a little seed of Epicurean philosophy over there. And so they could spout things that might seem like they know a lot about the subject, but really they're just a spermologos. They're just a seed picker. And that's what they're saying here. My version says idle babbler. But, that was a derogatory term. He's just some low-class Jew coming into our city. He's picked up a little bit here and there. He doesn't know anything. But then there are others who are saying, he seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities. He's talking about just Jesus and him being raised from the dead, So, boy, he's got some new mythology over here, They're kind of thinking, So we want to hear a little bit further about all this, So this is what's attracting the conversation here. Scott? Sure. Yeah. You don't ever start by insulting the person. Now, ultimately, he's correcting them. Ultimately, he's giving a criticism of them. But he doesn't start by insulting them.
But in a way, they look small.
Yeah. Who else raised their hand? Okay. All right. So let's just look at the reaction that he gets from these philosophers. And I want to just talk with you a little bit about these philosophical groups. If you understand this, it'll make so much sense of the reaction that they give Paul. The Epicureans that are talked about here, they were a philosophical school that was begun by Epicurus about 300 BC. And Epicureanism basically taught this view, that the world is a garden, and when you think of a garden, what do you think of? What?
Harvesting.
What else? A lot of plants.
Is the garden a pleasant place?
Nice place to be. Nice place to walk through. Smell good. The world
is a garden.
And is there anything in a garden you got to be afraid of? No. I hear about snakes, Well, garter snake. Not afraid of a garter snake, are you? Yeah. I would be, but... No, gardens are nice places. They were saying the world is a garden. And what they were doing is they were very much reacting to the paganism of their day. And they were saying that the Greeks and Romans have a history of worshiping these deities that everybody's afraid of. You don't want to get them angry at you. And so you give this
sacrifice
here and there. And they were not denying that the gods in some sense didn't exist. I mean, they were acknowledging that they existed, but they did not believe in all the mythologies and all that stuff. Because all those stories were just to scare little kids. The world's a garden. It's a pleasant place. Don't be afraid. Live your life. Nothing should scare us. Not that they said there's no
gospel.
Literally, I probably didn't word that well. But what they were saying was that these gods exist in another plane, and there's not, you know, gods there atop Mount Olympus that are going to come down and zap you with a lightning bolt or something. You know, don't worry about being judged by the gods. They also said there's no afterlife. Certainly no resurrection of the body. But not even an afterlife. So this life right here and now, this is it.
And so enjoy
it right now.
Find all the pleasant
things. And that's what they were teaching. They did believe in free will, that you weren't predetermined a certain way. And they said, seek pleasure, avoid pain. And sometimes the Epicureans were
sort of
cast as
hedonists, you know, just
pleasure at all costs. Awesome. But they recognized that you can have excessive pleasure and then it doesn't become pleasurable. So they said, you know, seek pleasure, usually in moderation, and try to avoid painful things in life, and that's what the goal of life is all about. Just live your life, find what pleases you, avoid pain, and just be concerned about that, and don't be concerned about having to placate some deities lest they come and judge on you. That's what the Epicureans are saying. Now, hang on just a second. Let me get through this. All right, then the other group that Paul talks with are the Stoics. And the Stoics got their name from the place where these philosophical schools would meet. They meet in the Stoa, the porticos, in these major cities of Greece. They were founded by Zeno about the same time as Epicurus. And Stoicism taught that there are no gods in the sense of personal beings, but they really taught a type of pantheism. That there is sort of a God force that permeates all living things. God is not really a person, they would say, but they would use terms
like Zeus or other terms like
that for a deity to talk about this impersonal force that just gives life to everything. I'll tell you a modern day parallel, and that's the Star Wars mythology. This let the
force
be with you, okay? I forget the creator of that series, George Lucas. He didn't just come up with that. I mean, you know, for the
first time,
that kind of a
pantheistic concept goes
way, way back. All right, so basically, though, and to me this is important, the Stoics, did they believe in one God? Monotheism? Yeah. Not
one God as a
personal being,
but one
God
force
that permeates all things. And that often refer to that God, that impersonal God, as Zeus, to make their message
palatable to the people of their culture.
All right, so the Stoics did not believe in free will. You have no freedom. Ultimately, your life is predetermined for you. There's no afterlife or resurrection. On that score, they were just like the Epicureans. All right, so with all of that background, can you see how the gospel that Paul was preaching, just the way that it would have hit those people? Okay. All right, we're almost out of time. Let me just show you real quickly a couple of things. Look at what Paul says in verse 24. The God who
made the world
and all things, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he served by human hands as though
he needed anything,
since
he himself
gives to all people life and breath and all things. Now, Paul's preaching a concept that deity does not need anything from human beings. Would that have squared with the thinking of the Stoics and the Epicureans? Yeah. Now, Paul is saying that this one God is a personal being, though. And that, of course, would not have squared with Stoic thinking.
But keep
going. Verse 26. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they should seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and exist, as even some of your own poets have said, for we also are his children. Now here's another political correctness. No, not really that, but just making the gospel palatable to the people. He quotes their philosophers, their poets, and uses that language but kind of redefines it. Aratus was a Stoic philosopher, a well-known Stoic philosopher, and this line, "We also are his offspring," that's what Aratus said, speaking of Zeus, this impersonal god force
that created all
things. Or that not
created in a personal way, but
that all things have sprung from. And so metaphorically, he then said, we also are his offspring. Paul quotes him. And he's saying, your poet, Aratus, got it right. We are the offspring of God. It's just that he's a personal being. He's not some impersonal force. And then he also quotes from Epimenides of Crete, who in his poem said, they fashioned a tomb for thee, Zeus, O high and holy one. The Cretans, always liars, evil beasts, idle bellies. But thou art not dead, thou livest and abideth forever. For in thee we live and move and have our being. All right, Paul wasn't the one who first said that. Paul's just quoting Epimenides. And we cite that a lot. But Paul's saying Epimenides was right in what he said about this ultimate being, Zeus.
But Epimenides just didn't understand
exactly who Zeus was, who this God was. So this one true God, the Father of Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, he's the one in whom we live and move and have our being. Okay. All right, we're going to stop there. And we'll pick up this Wednesday night.
Wednesday night,
we want to go through this and then through Acts chapter 18. So make sure you've read through that. Thank you, folks.